Before they came to the United States, Albert Einstein and his wife Elsa lived through some really difficult times in Germany. And money was very, very hard to come by. So Elsa would save old letters and scraps of paper for Albert to write things on and to do his calculations and his figuring. Years later, Elsa was on a tour in America of a research laboratory, and these scientists were trying really hard to impress her, and they were showing her all this latest scientific equipment, and they took her into an observatory, and they showed her this big, huge machine that was looked very intricate, and she said, "What's that thing for?" And the scientist in charge said very proudly, "Well, Mrs. Einstein, we use that equipment to probe the deepest secrets of the universe." And Mrs. Einstein said, "Oh, my husband used to do that on the back of old envelopes." There have been many great scientists, but there was only one Albert Einstein. In 1772, the town council of the city of Leipzig was looking for a person to be their cantor and the organist for the church and the school of St. Thomas. The council searched for this new person, and they picked one. This candidate said no, turned down the position. So then they tried their second pick. The second one said, "No, I've changed my mind, I don't want the job." And so they decided, as one of the members of the council later wrote, that since the best candidate could not be hired, a mediocre one would have to be accepted. The third choice they hired, the mediocre candidate, was Johann Sebastian Bach. That poor town council, they had to settle for one of the greatest music composers who ever lived. Charlie Chaplin was visiting with his friend Pablo Picasso, and Picasso accidentally spilled a little bit of paint on Charlie's trousers. Picasso said, "I'm so sorry, let me go get something to remove that." And Chaplin said, no, leave it there, and please sign your name right underneath it." Chaplin owned a Picasso now. Someone has said it is easier to get rich than it is to get really famous. And it's true. There are many rich people in the world, but there are very few people whose names are recognized every time they're spoken by everybody. And there are even less names that are known for generations after they die. People like Bach, like Einstein, like Chaplin, like Picasso. Those are names that hold a special place in history. And there's one name that stands above all the rest. That name is Jesus of Nazareth. There have been many who have left their print on the world, many who have done great things, but only one who tore down the wall between life and death, only one person, that humble carpenter. As someone has said, Jesus had no servants, yet they called him master. He had no degree, yet they called him teacher. He had no medicines, yet they called him healer. He had no army, yet kings feared him. He won no military battles, yet he conquered the world. He committed no crime, yet they crucified him. He was buried in a tomb, yet he lives today. Because of those lonely hours that Jesus spent on the cross, we sometimes forget how popular he was when his ministry first began. The scene we have in our scripture lesson that Terry read for us this morning takes place at the house of Simon Peter, where Jesus heals Simon's mother-in-law. Notice that what Mark says to us next, that evening after sunset, the people brought to Jesus all the sick. The whole town gathered at their door. Imagine that. If you live in LaSalle, imagine the whole city of LaSalle showing up at your doorstep. If you live in Peru, Peru, Granville, wherever you live, everybody was there. They wanted to see Jesus. And then we read, very early in the morning, while it was still dark, he got up and he left. And he went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Simon and his companions went to look for him, and when they found him, they said these words, "Everyone is looking for you." I don't know how to say it without sounding cliche, but I really do believe that deep down, many people today are looking for Jesus. They may not know his name. They might not use those words. They might use different phraseology, but they are looking for Jesus. There's a woman named Laura. She attended Mass at her first time at the age of 5. Her mom had just become a Catholic, and when Laura asked her mom about the church, mom said, "Jesus lives there." At the end of the Mass, Laura said, "I don't want to go home yet, Mom." "Well, why not, Laura?" "Because Jesus is here and I want to see him." Her mom tried to explain that Jesus was there in spirit, not in body, but Laura didn't get it. And finally, her mom grew impatient with her and said, "That's enough, let's go home." And she insisted. Mom said, "Let's go home." Then she bear hugged a post and said, "I am not leaving until I see Jesus." Her mother was embarrassed. She continued to plead with her. She continued to protest. The priest finally came over, bent down, took her by the hand, and he took her up to the altar and he showed her the sacraments. After a couple minutes, Laura returned back to her mom and she was ready to go home. That was 30 years ago. Today, people call Laura by a different name. She's Sister Laura. She became a nun, and she loves it. I guess we'd have to say that somehow, 30 years ago, in the sacraments, little Laura saw Jesus. Many people are looking for Jesus in their own way. We have what French mathematician and philosopher Blaise Pascal called a God-shaped void in our souls. We try to fill it with all kinds of substitutes, power, wealth, things, but nothing satisfies. And I think St. Augustine put it beautifully when he said, "Thou hast made us for thyself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until we rest in thee." We need to rest in God. Let's talk about a few things that Jesus showed us. For one thing, he showed us how to look at God. What's God like? Is God a personal God? Yes. Is God a loving God? Yes. Does God respond to our needs? Yes. And how do I know all these answers? Jesus. That's how. In his life and in his teachings, he shows us everything we need to know about God in this life. A little girl heard about the terrible, savage, bloody parts of the Old Testament, and it didn't even faze her. She said, "That all happened before God became a Christian." Well, her theology is a little oversimplified, but she's not real far off. Jesus gave us a clearer picture of what God is like than the Old Testament writers could possibly give us. Like the wealthy woman who spent half a lifetime touring all the great sights of the world, and she was bored. Then she met a Frenchman who was poor, but understood and had a great love of art and beauty. And he went with her on her tours, and with his help, things were completely different. And she said to him one day, "I never knew what things were like until you taught me how to look at them." Like that woman, we could not know We could not begin to understand anything about what God is like until we saw Jesus. He showed us how to look at God. Jesus also taught us how to look at life. How should we take life with its joys and its sorrows, its heartbreaks, its mountains, and its deep, deep valleys? There was a former NFL coach named Sam Ritigliano who spoke at a banquet. And people assumed that they were going to hear one of those typical sports banquet speeches where he would say that God helped him win so many games. Instead, he told the story of how he and his wife were driving one evening with their 2-year-old daughter in the back seat of the car, and there was an accident. The car rolled over. Their daughter was thrown out, and she was pinned underneath the car. So some of the people there probably expected him to say something like, "I found unbelievable strength in myself. I picked up the car by the back bumper and I pulled her out." Or, "An ambulance came and so did a tow truck and she was taken to the hospital. We prayed for months and she was finally healed and she's fine today." But instead, he said these three words: "She was dead." He then went on to tell how he and his wife grieved so deeply for so long over the death of their little girl. How it was an awful time in their life. Time went on. They got pregnant again, finally, in answer to prayer, and that baby was about to be delivered and was stillborn. It was too much for him to take, too much to handle, too much to grieve. Time went on again. Sam started to negotiate with God. He said, "God, if you will bless us with another baby, we'll give our lives to you. We'll dedicate that child to you. We'll see to it that he or she follows you faithfully. If you give us a healthy child, we will be yours and do what you want us to do for the rest of our lives. If you. And a quiet voice spoke to Sam's inner spirit: "No deals, Sam. No deals. No manipulations. I am your God in all the times of your life." Then Sam went on to say, "God called me to be his servant in my turf, the NFL. He rules over all aspects of my life, winning or losing, in triumphs and in tragedies. How about you? Where is your turf?" He said, "Does God rule where you live? Does God rule there in your turf, in your situation? Not just when you're winning, but when you're losing. Not just during the bad times, or the good times, but during the bad times as well. Does God rule then?" Here was a professional football coach who learned to look at life through the eyes of Jesus. No easy answers. Rain falls on the just and the unjust. But still, he said, "You can trust me." God said, "No matter good or bad." Don't let the prosperity preachers tell you anything different. Following Jesus will not guarantee your relationships will all be perfect. It won't guarantee healthy children. It won't guarantee fat bank accounts, but following Jesus will guarantee you that you're in line with God's purpose in your life. And it will guarantee you that, according to the scriptures, it says, neither life nor death nor powers nor principalities can separate you from God's love. Always remember that. Jesus taught us how to look at God. He taught us how to look at life. And he taught us how to look at one another. We are the people of the cross. He showed us, by his example, how to live in service to other people. There's a true story told by the grandfather of a 9-year-old boy named Mark. Mark's mother got a phone call one day in the middle of the afternoon. It was her son's teacher. "Mrs. Smith, something unusual happened today in class. Your son did something that surprised me so much that I thought you should know about it right away," the teacher said. She thought, oh no, what's he done? The teacher said, nothing like this has happened in all the years of my teaching. This morning I was teaching a lesson on creative writing. And as I always do, I tell the story of the ant and the grasshopper. The ant works hard all summer, and he stores up lots of food. But the grasshopper plays all summer long and does no work. Then winter comes. The grasshopper begins to starve because he has no food. So he begins to beg, please, Mr. Ant, you have much food. Please let me eat too. Then I said, boys and girls, your job is to write the ending to the story. Your son, Mark, raised his hand. When I called on him, he said, teacher, may I draw a picture? She said, well, yes, if you like, but first write the ending of the story. As in all the years past, most of the students said the ant shared his food throughout the winter, and the ant and the grasshopper both lived. A few kids wrote, the ant said, no, Mr. Grasshopper, you should have worked in the summer. I only have enough food for myself. And so the ant lived and the grasshopper died. But your son ended this story in a most unusual way. He wrote, so the ant gave all of his food to the grasshopper. The grasshopper lived through the winter. The ant died. And the picture, at the bottom of the page, Mark had drawn three crosses. This is the gospel. We are the people of the cross. Christ died for us. He gave his all, everything. We live for him. We live for one another. If you don't believe me, come to church here. Get to know these people. They live for one another. They live for God. When we understand that, life takes on a new meaning and a new sense of purpose. Jesus showed us how to look at God. Jesus showed us how to look at life. Jesus showed us how to look at one another. Christ gave his life for us. We give our lives in loving service to one another. Anybody ever ask you what the meaning of life is? That's it. I just summed it up. That's what it's all about. And living this way will bring you joy, not always happiness, but joy, something that's deeper down inside that cannot be described. No wonder the disciples said that day, everyone is looking for you. Many today are looking for him. Let's introduce him to them. Amen.